sun will give you the world. We bring good things to life. The news you need from people you can count on, doing what we do best. The heartbeat of America. Get the world every night as a TV show. The latest spin on the shit we're in, blow by blow. And the more you watch, the less you know.
Welcome to Unspun Experiment and Truth Telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. That music was from Jackson Browne's album Looking East. The title is Information Wars. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth tellers and advocates from around the world. We are now streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org. Click on the listen button. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. You can also, besides calling in, if you're a little shy, you can send me an email at unspun@kkrn.org, or you can follow me at DougBennett15 on Twitter. Today, our guest is Professor David Long. He's a spokesman for LEAP, which stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, which is a nonprofit organization made up of the current and former members of law enforcement and criminal justice communities who are speaking out about the failures of our existing drug policies. David Long served for nearly 9 years as a special agent with the U.S. Department of Labor Office of Inspector General, working union corruption, identity theft cases tied to the Mexican Mafia and Asian organized crime. David holds a BA magnum cum laude from Howard University. He also was elected Phi Beta Kappa. He earned his JD from the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He is a member of the State Bar of Georgia. Upon law school graduation, David served as law clerk to U.S. District Judge Clifford Scott Green of the U.S. District Court of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. David currently teaches a variety of criminal justice and legal study courses at Brandman University. As an idealistic University of Pennsylvania law students and young intern in the United States Attorney General's office in Philadelphia during the 1980s, David witnessed firsthand how lives of young men and women were drastically changed as they were sentenced to decades in prison as a result of their involvement in drugs. David also remembers hearing the misgivings of a particular assistant U.S. attorney regarding the impacts of the war on drugs. Years later, as a federal agent, David began to see the unmistakable link of how the drug trade fueled, funded, and helped to facilitate crimes he investigated. It became clear to David that many of the weapons and much of the money funding these crimes could be traced to the illegal drug trade. Later, as a professor of criminal justice and legal studies, David became convinced that the so-called war on drugs is an unsound policy and is, in fact, doing great harm to our society in many ways. As a professor, David began to notice and conduct research into how our nation's drug policies led to prison overcrowding and a disconnect in our social priorities. His research is what led him to LEAP. Here's a quote from him. "It has become clear to me that while we fill our prisons with low-level drug offenders, the illegal drug trade, drug abuse, and addiction continues in the face of the war on drugs. Until drugs are legalized and addiction abuse are treated first and foremost as a public health issue, the nation will face continuing problems resulting from overcrowded criminal dockets, overcrowded prisons, deaths as a result of drug overdosing, street violence, the spread of disease, ruined lives, and lost potential. Now let's welcome Professor David Long. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth telling.
Thank you, Doug. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, what a great and varied career you've had. I had to stumble over part of it, actually, trying to read it. Pretty impressive.
I'm somebody that never really decided what they wanted to do when they grew up.
Well, I can relate to that entirely. I'm on my fourth career, and I'm not sure I want to do that one. So, I understand that, and I think that's a good sign. So, but in your career, and to get back to the issues that we're here to speak to, as a former law enforcement officer. Was there something specific that really made it clear to you that our so-called war on drugs is not working?
I think for me, there was never an epiphany. My conclusion came along a continuum, I think. You mentioned in your introduction that I interned in the U.S. Attorney's Office while in law school in Philadelphia. And I remember that was probably 1988 or so, and I do remember being in the courtroom while these defendants in what's called a continuing criminal enterprise were being sentenced to prison for the distribution of crack cocaine in North Philadelphia. And then the amount of crack cocaine I remember was actually in the courtroom, sitting on the table, the prosecutor's table, and it was, you know, if you looked at it, it wasn't a shocking amount of crack cocaine. And I watched as these young men, they were about my age at the time, their late 20s, literally get sentenced to 30, 40 years in prison. And at the time, I felt sadness for them. However, if you had asked me as I watched it, I'd say, well, you know, they did the crime, now they got to do the time. So I was not of the mindset I am of today. However, during that same time, during that internship, I do remember an assistant U.S. attorney that was actually transferring out of drug prosecutions and into the prosecution of environmental crimes. And I remember him sitting there talking to myself and a prosecutor I was working with and a DEA agent that I was also working with. And he said, you know, these drug prosecutions are stupid. There's just no end to it. We're not stopping anything by putting people in prison. And we were all, the rest of us sitting there were silent. We probably all disagreed with him. But he planted a seed because this is somebody I really respect, but I never really followed up with as far as what his thoughts were behind what he was saying. But then many years later, as a federal agent, working cases that were primarily, they were not drug cases. However, it became clear to me that much of the money that was being used to further these crimes that I was investigating were coming from drug proceeds, and in addition, the weaponry that we were finding during these so-called white collar criminal cases that I was working were far beyond what you would imagine a white collar criminal would possess. And so it gradually became clear to me that our drug policy was furthering and touching a lot more than just drug crimes per se. And then as a professor, I began to do research and about criminal justice reform, prison overcrowding, and that really crystallized the fact that the war on drugs was really a way, really a war of people, and a really just fundamentally a bad idea.
And the other thing we could probably point out is your colleague, Norm Stamper, former police chief of Seattle. I've had him on the show a couple of times. And there's also a racial bias, as you were pointing out. You know, the white-collar drug user is, you know, snorting cocaine while maybe the kid on the street is selling crack cocaine for survival. And so you have this other social aspect of this that maybe you could talk to that, because I know it's truly lopsided when you look at the statistics.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, you really can't have a serious discussion about the war on drugs or current drug policy without talking about race and racial disparity. I hear drug policy discussions all the time, and sometimes they sit there for an hour and talk about drug policy and don't mention race, which is astounding to me. But I do understand that, having been a speaker for LEAP for a few years, that the racial disparity argument really doesn't resonate with some groups of people. Some groups of people don't care that there's more black men in prison than there were slaves in 1850. They just don't care. They go to they're more concerned about the dollars and cents argument, which I can make very strongly as well. But you alluded to the disparity in sentencing for between crack cocaine and powdered cocaine, which was simply outrageous. Which is still simply outrageous. It's less outrageous since Congress made some revision to that several years ago. But there's still a huge racial disparity in sentencing, and that's mandatory sentencing. So I remember, as a judicial law clerk to my former judge, who's now passed away, I had a very interesting discussion with him as his law clerk, and I asked him, I said, "Judge, what do you believe the reason is behind these disparity in crack cocaine and powdered cocaine sentencing in the sentencing guidelines?" I said, what is grounding that? And he sat there and he looked me dead in the eye and he said, "You know, I really cannot tell you a sound reason for that other than race." Even a judge who was sentencing people pursuant to these guidelines saw a racial bias inherent in that. Speaking on more broadly on racial bias, the racial groups in the United States, all the various racial groups, use drugs roughly at the same proportion. So African Americans don't use drugs any more than whites, or any more than Asians, or any more than Hispanics. However, African Americans are targeted for arrest at roughly four times the level that Caucasians are. So there's a huge unexplained racial discrepancy going on in enforcement. And you know, various writers have researched reasons for that, and some have come to different conclusions. But I'll leave it at that. But there is a huge unexplained reason for targeting of African Americans for arrest when they don't use drugs any more than any other group in the nation.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Professor David Long, spokesman for LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We're discussing the failed war on drugs and marijuana legalization, among other things, including the racial disparity within our criminal justice. I'm sorry, I want to put justice in quotes, our criminal justice system. And you can call in and be part of the discussion. If you have questions or comments, call 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. We invite your questions and comments. Well, I think most people that are paying attention, which is not that large a percentage of our population, but those that are understand the injustice of the war on drugs, even since we've moved into legalizing marijuana both recreationally and for medical use, there's still a huge move by law enforcement, those still working in law enforcement, and locally we have a huge problem here. They find ways to criminalize people that are even using medical marijuana according to state guidelines in California. And I'm sure some of my listeners are part of that group. Maybe you could talk to why that is. Why do we have this disparity between federal, state, and local laws?
Yeah, well, that, you know, that the underlying reason is because due to our system of federalism, where the federal government has certain powers enumerated to it, and everything else that is not specifically enumerated to the federal government is the responsibility of the state. So you have different, you know, states are allowed to have different criminal laws, different criminal justice systems, so that's the basic reason for the disparity. On this issue, as far as cannabis is concerned, you know, marijuana is considered a Schedule I drug under federal guidelines, which means that is the most considered the most dangerous type of drug. For example, heroin is a Schedule I drug. So under federal law, as we speak here today, marijuana is flat out illegal. Now, states have, you know, states like California and a few others have put into place medicinal marijuana programs, which are still illegal under federal law. And so, you would have the potential, and we've had it in the past, of this weird type of scheme where the DEA may come in and raid a medicinal marijuana dispensary in San Francisco or Los Angeles or wherever in the state of California. There was a huge raid a few years ago in Oakland. So that's the reason for the disparity. Now, when Colorado, I believe, legalized marijuana, the federal government basically stated that they would back off enforcement of federal marijuana law if the state of Colorado could properly enforce their new law, keeping it away from kids, not selling to minors, that sort of thing. So we've got we're in a kind of a weird situation right now, where the feds are kind of looking and waiting to see what's going to happen on the local level. In some ways, it reminds me of alcohol prohibition, because during alcohol prohibition, it was a clear failure, just as the war on drugs is, and the federal government was not the first governmental institution to move to repeal prohibition. The states were. So various states started repealing their own prohibition laws, and eventually the feds came along more or less kicking and screaming to repeal alcohol prohibition.
Well,
because
David,
fundamentally...
Yeah,
yes.
We have a caller, so she's been on the line waiting for about 3 minutes, so I'd like to take her call. Let me bring her on. Pamela, you're on the air.
Well, good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Great show. I have a question, kind of a two-part question. I'd like to preface it a little bit, and then I'll hang up. It would appear, I'm an educator, and there's a book called The War on Drugs is the War on Black Males by Dr. Earl Hutchinson, and it seems as though Angela Davis as well would suggest that, you know, we move from slavery times to the prison industrial complex, you know, another form of slavery. And so it would appear that, you know, people of color are really targeted here, and there's so much money to be made. the U.S. population doesn't seem sympathetic to people who are incarcerated. So, you know, and the private prison complex, you know, just lobbies three strikes. And so do you see that there's a, I mean, would you agree that it's targeting with people of color? And then how we deal with that, that racial divide? So I'll hang up. Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Pamela.
Yeah, I think, like I mentioned earlier, I definitely think, I think it's a fact. I think it's very difficult to argue that African Americans are not targeted for arrest out of proportion to their usage numbers of drugs, because the facts are the facts that blacks don't use drugs anymore, use or possess drugs in any higher proportion than the rest of the population. And so the fact that they're in residing in prison in numbers far greater than their use and possession would indicate they are targeted out of proportion. So there is, in my view, in my research, there is a disconnect. There's huge amounts of money in the criminal justice system. You mentioned private prisons, and not just as far as the war on drugs is concerned. Private prisons really have an interest in maintaining the status quo as far as undocumented immigrants, because when they're in lockup in private prisons, they're making money. There's the California Correctional Officers Union, which is a staunch supporter of the war on drugs. There's the police departments, police agencies that make huge amounts of money on civil forfeiture cases, which is, you know, of great concern, where guilt does not even have to be proven before property can be seized from an individual suspected of using drugs or possessing drugs. So we have a whole system here that kind of feeds off off the status quo, war on drugs. So there would have to be huge political change, and there is some there are some noises being made about criminal justice reform now, which I didn't even hear from politicians several years ago. So it's a massive system, the criminal justice prison industrial complex that would be affected by dismantling of the war on drugs. Now, I would like to say there are plenty of people that belong in prison out there, but they're not necessarily drug users. There's people like murderers, rapists, and those people. And if the war on drugs was scaled back or diverted or simply drugs were legalized, controlled, and regulated, law enforcement could really go about doing its business of protecting people from other people, not protecting people from themselves. And I think that's the fundamental disconnect in the current war on drugs. Whenever we try and protect each other, protect one from themselves, I don't believe that's the job of law enforcement.
Now, there's no true victim in many of these drug enforcement type crimes at all.
Right.
And what you mentioned, which I think is interesting, in California, we did pass Prop 47, what was that, a couple of years ago or a year ago? And what I call the authoritarians out there, the ones that like to keep the status quo and empower it even more, they were all up in arms here locally on the local right-wing radio shows talking about, you know, how we're allowing rapists and murderers back on the street. And really, that wasn't part of it, as I understood. And so I don't know if you were involved with Prop 47 or not, but I'm sure you probably have an opinion on how well that's worked out.
Well, I haven't followed it closely, but to the extent that somebody would say, well, they're letting rapists and murderers out on the street, I would say, well, we need to rethink our policy, our drug policy, because Our drug policy is what is filling the prisons, not rapists and murderers. So if we stop imprisoning low-level drug offenders, and not all low-level drug offenders go to prison, but if we stop incarcerating lower-level drug offenders, I would submit we'd have more room for the people that actually belong in prison. Another thing I'd like to touch on, though, as an advocate of legalization, control, and regulation, I'd like to address something that some of your listeners may be thinking as they're hearing me speak. People that are in favor of legalization, control, and regulation are not in favor of everybody getting their hands, meaning children, on any drug anytime they want to. That is absolutely not at the heart of the legalization control argument. The people that are in favor of the current war on drugs, they're actually in favor of that, unwittingly, probably. Because if you have an uncontrolled market, which we have now, we have an uncontrolled market in drugs, we have cannabis, whatever, any drug that's illegal, we've created an uncontrolled market, a black market, because when you ban something that people want to use, it doesn't go away; it goes to the black market. So we've given the black market criminals, the drug trafficking organizations, carte blanche to produce, market, and distribute the drug. It's going to be here one way or the other. So drugs are going to be here one way or the other. So the question is, if I ask the audience a question, if I say, how many of you think we can ever get rid of drugs completely from society? Even the most conservative audience will not say, I think that's a real possibility. So everyone agrees we're not going to get rid of drugs. So given that, what's the best way to deal with drugs that are here already, or going to be here? Is the best way to give the market to criminal drug trafficking organizations to be responsible for the distribution? I would say no. So by legalizing a drug, it's not the same thing as condoning a drug.
Let me remind our listeners one more time. You're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Professor David Long, spokesman for LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We're discussing the war on drugs, the failed war on drugs, marijuana legalization, and existing prohibition laws and why they're not working. If you'd like to call in and comment or have a question, call in 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. My friend Willie McCarty, who's in the studio with me, we were talking before the show, and it looks like he might have a question, but okay. I think he does have a question, so let's put him on the air. Yeah, Willie, what was your question?
You know, what seems to me is, thank you, David, for the work you're doing first. I really appreciate it. That what happens with legalization of marijuana is it opens a door when it's a criminal offense. It opens a door for someone who's interested in doing something that's helps in their lives to making them a criminal. So all of a sudden it opens the door to looking out there for other harsher drugs to be in their world. They're starting to associate with a criminal element that's wouldn't be in their world at all if marijuana was just. I'm trying to separate between cocaine and marijuana. Cocaine and many of the harder drugs, and I think there's some point to that we sometimes eliminate just. Make a criminal out of the general public, and then all of a sudden it becomes more acceptable to do something else.
Well, and this might be the old, I think Willie's kind of alluding to the old gateway drug concept.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so what's your comment on that?
Yeah, so the allusion is to the gateway theory, which has been totally discredited. Marijuana, use of marijuana you could say it's correlated with use of harder drugs is like saying that riding a tricycle is correlated as a child is correlated with an adult as driving a car. I mean, it's ridiculous. However, the point that you were making is true. If we have a legalized, control and regulated scheme in place, a purchaser of marijuana is going to purchase marijuana only. If the drug is illegal, when a person who could very well be underage goes to buy some marijuana, the drug dealer, first of all, doesn't ask for ID. The only question, they have two questions. How much money do you have? And would you like to try this other drug? And so that's the only correlation, the only support I would give the gateway theory is that it operating in an unregulated environment, people are potentially exposed to other more dangerous or harder drugs than marijuana. So that's my take on it.
Yeah. My thought has always been, why is it so difficult to see? You already have alcohol, which was prohibited in the 20s and led to the same illicit drug traffic and all the famous gangsters. And now you have alcohol advertised every day around the world and probably more in the United States. And it is more deadly, more toxic, causes more problems legally. So why is it so hard for people to see that you could simply treat marijuana like you treat alcohol? It just seems a no-brainer.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think that I've heard the argument that, you know, okay, we have all these problems with alcohol, so why do we add another drug to the mix and add all those concomitant problems that come along with it? And my response is, it's already here. So why don't we deal with it in a way that we can at least manage some control over it? Because the drug is already, it's not an issue of marijuana or no marijuana. Marijuana is here, and it's here to stay. It's been here. It's not going anywhere. So let's talk about the best way to deal with it. And the best way to deal with it is to bring it out of the dark into the light, and control it and regulate it and keep it out of the hands of kids. And one of the things I hear mostly is, well, I'm concerned about my 14-year-old daughter or son having access to it. Well, their access to it right now is far greater than alcohol, precisely because alcohol is legal and controlled and regulated. Because if their 14-year-old goes into a 7-Eleven and tries to buy a six-pack of beer, the first thing the clerk will ask them for is an ID. However, that same 14-year-old, if they're in that kind of neighborhood, could go behind for the 7-Eleven and go to their drug dealer. And the only question, as I just mentioned, is how much money do you have and what else would you like besides this marijuana? And so it's not...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. It's not condoning drug use any more than we condone use of alcohol or condone smoking. I would ask a smoker, I'm not a smoker, I'd ask any smoker how condoned they feel smoking in California. Nicotine is one of the most addictive drugs known to man. And through education programs, we have cut the number of smokers in the United States over the last 40 years by 50% without throwing one person in prison.
We have another caller, so I'd like to take that call right now.
Sure.
Melita, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Professor Long, for what you're doing. I have a question regarding another issue that's come up in more recent times about the issue of heroin in our suburban and rural areas of America, how that's increased dramatically over recent years. And can you talk to that a bit and what you may see as some of the sources of this? My research has shown that predominantly that comes from Mexico and South America and those countries, but there is some indication that this huge increase in the development of the poppy seeds in Afghanistan are also making its way into the United States. Can you talk to that a bit, and I'll take your answer up the air. Thank you.
And thanks for the question.
Sure. Thank you. I can talk a little bit about heroin. Yeah, there has been a supposedly an uptick, especially in rural areas, of heroin use and abuse. I'm not sure of the sources myself of where the production originates. However, I transfer the cannabis argument very much toward heroin as well. Here's a drug that's admittedly far more dangerous than marijuana. However, if it's left uncontrolled, unregulated, we are going to have, we're going to have the same issues. In addition, with a drug like heroin, if it's used injected, we have the issues of blood-borne infections such as, HIV and hepatitis B, which are easily passed through the use of infected needles. And here, treating heroin dependence as a public health issue rather than an issue of a criminal justice issue really makes a lot of sense. In a country like Portugal, which has decriminalized all drugs in 2001, the incidence of bloodborne infections from drug infected needles is far less than any other country where prohibitionist policies are in place. And that's the exact opposite of what pro-war on drug people were saying when Portugal instituted their new law. So I think we do all of the population in general a disservice by criminalizing somebody that has admittedly, if you're addicted to develop a dependence on heroin, you are suffering from a huge personal health crisis. And I don't think the issue is facilitated by throwing that person in prison. I think it's facilitated by getting them treatment. And right now, treatment is often not available or not available on a timely basis for those individuals. And so what they do is while they're out on bond to feed their habit, they commit crimes. And if we have a legalized, controlled, and regulated market for a drug like heroin, we actually have treatment and counseling for those people because we're not spending public funds to incarcerate them. Those funds go to treatment and counseling and education. So the incidence of dependence actually falls. In a country like Portugal, the first couple of years after decriminalization, which is not as preferable to legalization, the country experienced a slight uptick in the use of drugs for about 2 years, and then it went back to prohibition levels. So there was not this explosion, long-term explosion of drug use and crime and all the ills that people that rail against legalization often claim. The evidence is just not there.
I think that's been substantiated in many places around the world. But we have another caller, so we'll come back to that. Maybe the more positive sides of what LEAP is encouraging us to do. But let's take this caller. I have to warn you, I have pretty intelligent callers, so they
yeah,
ask some pretty good questions. So, Randy, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've noticed that in the past years, while y'all been fighting about the dangers of marijuana, the pharmaceuticals have become so ingrained in our system. Part of the kids are fed pharmaceuticals at school, and half the adult, or I don't know about half, but a large percentage of our population are taking antidepressants and a variety of pharmaceuticals that are advertised everywhere. And now the mass shooters, we find have many of the mass shooters of these mass shootings have pharmaceutical drugs in their systems. And so how can we have an honest conversation about the danger of drugs without, bringing pharmaceuticals into the equation and comparing them with whatever dangers and concerns there are with marijuana?
Good question.
That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Randy.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. Big Pharma is a big player with a lot of political power. And it's, I don't know what Big Pharma is actually doing as behind the scenes as far as these drugs that are currently illicit. I have some suspicion that part of the anti-legalization lobby is funded by Big Pharma, knowing that eventually legalization, certainly for cannabis, it will be here, and for them to kind of hold back on it, wanting to hold back on it while they can figure out a way to pharmaceuticalize these various drugs that may become legal in the future. As to the issue of, many people, today depending on legal pharmaceuticals, that's a huge issue. As far as the mass shootings that we continue to experience, that's kind of out of the purview of LEAP. I can speak personally. I look at that as a symptom of societal breakdown and sickness and a public health issue. Most shooters do display, it's not like, I don't think most of these mass shooters just one day just snap. I think you can look at their behaviors and can come up with some relatively consistent behavioral patterns among these mass shooters. So that's what I have to say on that.
Yeah, sometimes cause and effect are hard to separate, and it's hard to tell unless you really have some meaningful look or study into some of that behavior. So, they may correlate, but they may not be the cause. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Right, right.
Well, let's we pretty much establish that the so-called war on drugs is a failure, like just about every other war we're involved in, by the way, if people aren't paying attention. But it's a failure because, and I think it's interesting because it's probably a failure for the same reason other wars are a failure. We're creating enemies. We're creating the bad guy so that we can justify what goes on in law enforcement. And we've seen this with Black Lives Matters, and as we've discussed here, the disparity in prison population and drug use, it's obviously a broken system. So besides that, which I think we pretty well established, how do we look forward? We have four states now in the United States of America that have legalized recreational use of marijuana. So how is that working out, and how does that work with what LEAP is proposing?
Well, I think the legalization initiatives that these Colorado, Oregon, Washington, Alaska have enacted, I think it's a wonderful thing. They're all different, slightly different in character. Probably Colorado's is the most fleshed out right now. The beautiful thing is each state is conducting an experiment in legalization and control and regulation. And because each state has a different rolled it out differently, I look at it as each state as a mini laboratory for legalization, control, and regulation. And so will everybody get it right? Will any of them get it right the first time? Probably not. There'll have to be some refinements made in the process, in the law, in the way things are handled. But, all these scare tactics I hear coming out of anti-legalization crowd, it's don't amount to a hill of beans as far as stopping the tide of legalization. For example, you know, Colorado has not had an increase in violent crime, which people said that was going to happen. I've not seen any children buying marijuana at these places, at their retail establishments. I've heard there was 700 million dollars in sales tax collected by the state of Colorado, which can be somewhat concerning if the taxes are too onerous and regulation is too onerous on these establishments, because then there's a risk of creating a secondary black market, which would not, you know, which would defeat the whole point of legalization. Here in California, you know, we do not have marijuana legalized for personal use. However, I'm almost 100% positive there will be an initiative on the ballot in 2016, next year. And right now there's about six major groups in California working on six different initiatives. But what they're working on is trying to come to a consensus so only one initiative will be put on the ballot, because if there's more than one, it will virtually assure the defeat of personal use in the state. But one initiative is on the ballot. It's most likely going to pass. Polls show it would pass by a strong margin, actually. Here in California, you know, the Golden Triangle up north, Humboldt, Mendocino area, is looking at the $12 billion wholesale market. That figure alone is a larger figure than all the other states that have legalized marijuana combined. So if California were to legalize personal use, that would really, really change the whole tide. I mean, the tide is going toward legalization and regulation right now, but for California to pass an initiative permitting personal use would really turn the tide.
And I've sat in on some of these meetings with local growers and medical marijuana advocates and owners of the few dispensaries, but that's really the incorrect term, collectives, that have been trying to promote medical marijuana and legalize recreational marijuana. And I'll tell you what, it's like being in a tag team wrestling match. Because so many of these people are coming from different points, and some of
Absolutely.
Them are looking at it strictly as a business. Others are looking at it as freedom. I mean, literally freedom from oppression. And so we have all these points of view. So I worry that they will not come up with hopefully there's somebody bright enough that will take the lead and say, look, you can't go at it like this. Simply get it legalized first, and then, like you say, you know, get a commission set up the rules. But to me, it's all over hype, because really you just treat it like alcohol. We have excise tax, sales tax.
Right.
Look at what it costs for a carton of cigarettes. I mean, these are things called sin taxes, right? And you know, it's not really rocket science. But if you're going to fight amongst yourselves over getting it on the ballot, and then you're going to, you know, split the voters, you know, going all kinds of different directions.
It's a useless exercise, man.
Yeah, it becomes pretty futile at that point. And so I agree with you. And if any of you growers or others are out there listening, call in and provide us with your opinion. But, I sat through a couple of long sessions and with some of the people, and it's amazing the different perspectives on how to deal with it. But most of those people are, like I say, their motivation may not be all that pure. They're looking at big bucks. And they want to make sure that, you know, they get in and they get their dime's worth or whatever. But Oregon, and I don't know if you've been following it, seems to have a pretty sensible way about going forward with all of this. And maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about what they're doing.
I think Oregon passed, I think it's measure, trying to keep up with all these states. I think it's measure 91
or something like that.
Yeah. And, you know, they're, it's interesting. I like their formula. You know, the tax revenue the state collects from sales will go to, you know, mental health and treatment, school funding, which is great. Some will go to law enforcement, and you know, if they're not out arresting people for cannabis possession, that's a good thing. So we'll have more money for law enforcement to do the actual jobs as well. You know, the Oregon, they've got they're still working out their regulatory details. So they have until, even though they passed the law, they have until the end of this year to really work out the regulatory details. So I'm not really sure. I don't believe, and I could be wrong, I don't believe that the dispensaries are allowed for medical use, are allowed to distribute personal use. And I could be wrong.
I think you are. I think what they've got in place, from what I've read over the last few days, and they've only been open in place since the beginning of this month. So, like you say, it hasn't evolved very much. But I think they're giving the dispensaries the first crack at selling recreational because they already understand and they're licensed under state law. So I believe they're making people that want to sell strictly on a recreational basis wait a while, and allowing these dispensaries to do what they've been doing, only they open it up a little bit more to, you know, anybody over 21, you know.
Right.
That, of course, you have to show ID and all of that. So, you know, so I think it's pretty sensible in that sense. But they're looking at quite a bit of income. And as you say, it's not just a one-sided thing of income, but also you're not spending money prosecuting, arresting, prosecuting, jailing, which is what? It's a huge amount of money. I don't know if you've got a figure for that on a yearly basis, say for California, but it's a huge amount of money.
Well, yeah, I mean, a few years ago, and I'm not so sure if it still stands, that California was spending, as of 2011 at least, I think is the last figure I have seen, California was spending more on incarceration than on public schools, which is just, I mean, I was floored when I first found that out.
Yeah, I think the figure I heard was for each inmate in the California prison system, $58,000 a year is spent, regardless
right.
of the crime, you know, just in general,
right.
average $58,000 a year. And, of course, we have a stuffed full prison system here in California, and we were ordered by the court to let some of those
right.
people out. The low-level offenders. So we're working against ourselves on both ends.
And on that point, drug treatment is a fraction of that. It costs a fraction of that $58,000, but we don't have the money for it because we're spending it on prison.
Yeah. So it sounds like we're going the right directions in some states. What are your thoughts about? Is it going to be on the ballot here in California, and what do you think is going to happen? I know you spoke to that a little bit before, but...
Yeah, I actually think it most definitely will be on the ballot. I do think that the people will put aside their differences in these various interest groups, and will get an initiative on the ballot. Once an initiative is on the ballot, I believe it will handily pass, and we will have some form of personal use for cannabis here in California. And I think that's a wonderful thing. It may not be in the exact form that I would have wished for, but I think to continue this insanity that we have here now with our broken criminal justice system, with our broken medicinal marijuana system, I think we need personal use, and the sky will not fall when it comes.
You only have a couple more minutes, or I should say we only have a couple more minutes here or less. Are there websites, things people can do to help out with the proposals that LEAP's making? Is there something we can do?
Well, you can check out our website and peruse it and see what types of activities LEAP is involved in. Anybody can join LEAP. Only to be a speaker for LEAP, you have to be current or former law enforcement, but anybody can join LEAP and be involved in what we're doing. We're an international organization. I think LEAP has been around since 2001, and it's just grown by leaps and bounds. And even though we are making some headway, LEAP and other groups like Drug Policy Alliance, making headway in this fight, it's a long way from being over. And I would invite anybody to check out our website and check out our list of speakers. If you'd like to have a speaker in your area, there probably is one in your area, and I encourage you to check it out.
All right. Well, that's you'll hear some music coming on here shortly, and that's our cue to sign off. So I want to thank you, Professor David Long, for being on Unspun and Experiment and Truth-Telling with us today.
Thank you, Doug.
And
that's a standing ovation from Willie.
Well,
we do appreciate
you so much.
Your work.
I enjoyed being here. Thank you.
Thank you once again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, you've been listening to Unspun and Experiment in Truth-Telling. Our guest today has been Professor David Long, former law enforcement officer, current law professor and spokesman for LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We've been discussing medical marijuana or marijuana legalization and law enforcement policies and the war on drug or the so-called war on drug. And I'll put links to LEAP's website and other agencies if you want to get involved. And I'll do that and with the archives of this show, and they'll be up on kkrn.org probably before the end of the weekend. Next week on Unspun, we'll be talking to Kathy Boylan, outspoken critic of the Pope from the Catholic Workers House in Washington, D.C. Tune in next Saturday, 9 a.m. Pacific on KKRN Community Radio. Next up, Peace Talks Radio.